this 2 days, 3 days. First time I've ever heard of the camp. Was not familiar with it at all. Have been totally impressed. You guys have been very friendly. Thank you. You've been very kind to me in just reaching out to me. So I'm looking forward to now sharing with you. Mike, great job. Great job with the testimony. Pat him on the back and say, good job. Good job. Good job. And by the way, you look good bald. That's a good look for you. It's a good look for you. Wayne, that was amazing. James, that was awesome. Thank you for taking us into the Word, unpacking that, man, going deep. Now, if you're looking for a speaker different than those two guys, you picked the right man. You have picked the right man because I really focus on practical Christian living. How do we take the Word of God, how do we apply it to our lives, and how do we live it out on a daily basis? So just to let you know, that is the direction I'm going to be heading in my two opportunities to get to speak to you. So here's what I want you to do as we start off my session. I want you in just a second to stand up, and for as many men as you can get to in front of you and behind you, I just want you to give them a high five, and I want you to say to them, it's good to be a man. Ready? Go. Do that. Oh, it's good to be a man. All right, good job. Go ahead and grab a seat. Good job. It is good to be a man. And I want to say that in some cases the world looks at us and says all the problems in the world are on our shoulders. It's because of us. And I All right, you could either say Semper Fi, always faithful, or you could say the few, the proud, the Marines. Now, if you see commercials for the United States Army, turn to the man next to you. What's a motto for the United States Army? Go. Okay, you could either say, be all that you can be. They're bringing back those commercials. Be all that you can be. Or you could say, Army strong. Army of one. Now I could ask you Air Force. Now I could ask you Navy. But best of all, turn back to the man next to you and tell him, what's the motto of the United States Coast Guard search and rescue? Go. All right, look back up here. I asked that question once, and a guy in the front went, sink or swim? No, no, that's not the motto. The motto of the U.S. Coast Guard Search and Rescue, I believe, is what it means to be a man. And the motto is this: you have to go out. You don't have to come back. You have to go out. You don't have to come back. I want to say, men, that God has called us to greatness. He has called us to be heroes of the faith. He has called us to stand in the gap on behalf of those who are struggling, on behalf of those who are hurting, to make a difference, to invest in others. And so in the two times I have to speak, that's what I'm going to call us to. And this morning, I'm going to take you to a famous passage. Most of you, I would guess, have this memorized. It's in the book of Micah. Micah chapter 6 and verse 8. Micah chapter 6 and verse 8. And I'm also using the New International Version. Micah 6, 8 says this: He has shown you, O mortal, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you? So let me stop right there. Let me just remind you that if you are a Christ follower, if you claim to be a Christ bearer and bringing the light, and you love Jesus, this is required of you. This is not optional. This is not like, okay, maybe if I have time, and maybe if I can fit it in, and maybe if I feel like it, and maybe it's convenient. No. No. God is saying, if you're going to follow me, if you're going to claim to be my child, this is what I require of you. This is not optional. But here's the bonus. He has shown you, O mortal, what is good. So not only is this required of you, but men, this is good for us. That if we would do this, if we would take these steps, it will not just represent the Lord well, it will benefit us as men also. So what is that? Well, he has shown you, O mortal, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you? To act justly and to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. Number one, act justly. Act justly. Think in your own mind right now, what does that mean to you? If I would call you to act justly, what does that mean to you? Today, I see two types of men. I see moral men. Well, I see more than two types. I see moral men, I see men of character, I see corrupt men. But I want to talk a second about moral men and men of character. If I had to define a moral man compared to a man of character, here's how I define it. A moral man chooses not to do what's wrong. A man of character does what's right. Now, if that seems the same to you, I want to say to you that that is radically different. A moral man tends to be a passive man. And a moral man tends to have a list of things he doesn't do. I don't smoke. I don't chew. I don't go with girls who do. So you've got this list of things. And you don't do these things. And what you have a tendency to do is then, you take your list and you compare it to other men's lists. And if the other man's list does not match up to your list, you have a tendency to be judgmental. You have a tendency to look down on this person. And today, churches are filled with moral men. And I want to say that God has called us to more than that. God has called us to be men of character. God has called us to live out our faith. God has called us to be active in our commitment to Him, to be obedient to His calling, to say to Him, Lord, whatever. I'll go wherever you want me to go. I'll do whatever you want me to do. I'll tell you a little more about my family down the road, but my youngest son, Garrett, And I'll tell you a couple of stories about him today. But when he was in high school, he came to me and he said to me, "Dad, you want to know the best way to die?" And I'm like, well, you know, off the top of my head, while I'm asleep and somebody's rubbing my feet. That was my initial thought. And my son, Garrett, says to me, "As a martyr for Christ." And I said to him, "You know what, bud? You are absolutely right. It's true. I want you to know that I spend a lot of time speaking to high school and middle school. I do that because we pretty much have the same maturity level. And can I bring you some good news today? From high school and middle school, God is raising up young men and women who are heroes of the faith. Young men and women who are committing to follow Jesus no matter what. Young women who are being called back to modesty and taking stands for modesty. Young men and women who are being called during the day to walk across their secular campuses during the day and just singing worship songs. God leading young men and women to pray over their schools and asking God to give them their schools. Young men and women who are willing to sacrifice for the cause of Christ. That's what it means to be a man of character. And so if I could define acting justly, I would say this. To act justly is to be a man of character who does what is right in God's sight. Not the sight of the world, God's sight. When Garrett was in middle school, he came up to me and he said to me, "Dad, there were a bunch of kids making fun of this kid in school, but I want you to know I didn't make fun of him." And I said, "Garrett, that is so good." I said, "Garrett, I am so proud of you. Garrett, that is awesome. You are a very moral young man. Thank you for not making fun of this kid. But Garrett, were you a man of character? Garrett, did you step into the midst of these people and say, stop making fun of this kid?" See, being a man of character is not about winning a popularity contest. You know, the world hated Jesus, and we're Christ followers. The world is not going to love us. But we are called to make a difference. We are called to represent the Lord well, and we are called to go and to do whatever he is calling us to do. So I was born in San Francisco, the home of the almost world champion San Francisco 49ers. I was raised in a town called Walnut Creek, right by San Francisco. I was raised in a cult. So I was raised a Christian Scientist. So turn to the man next to you and tell them everything you know about Christian Science. Ready? Go. Is this water for me? Thank you. Okay, some men say to me, "Oh, this is Tom Cruise." No. No, that's Scientology, okay? That's totally different. This is Christian Science. The founder is Mary Baker Eddy. The mother church is in Boston. It's a dying church. They do not proselyte. You'll never have anybody knock on your door who's a Christian Scientist. They do not believe there is a hell. Jesus is a good man. Everybody goes to heaven. You never get sick. You never get hurt. If you were to get hurt, you would call a practitioner. They would come to you. They'd read to you from Key to the Scriptures by Mary Baker Eddy, and then you would get well immediately. So that's how I'm raised. And we're kind of backslidden Christian Scientists. I mean, how low can you get? Okay, we're backslidden Christian Scientists. So we're not even good in the cult. Really, we're not into it very much. As a senior in high school, I received, actually my junior year, I received a severe knee injury while playing baseball. My sport that I loved was football. But my mother would not come to the football games because she thought it was too violent. So she wanted me to play baseball, and I had a guy dive into my knee, rip out all my ligaments, just ended everything. Boom. And my parents took me to the doctor, and they did major surgery on me. And my grandmother, who was a staunch Christian Scientist, she was so upset, so mad. And the church kind of looked down on us, and so we were kind of ostracized. So I have friends, but I'm on this big full-length cast, and I can't do anything. I can't go anywhere. And all my friends slowly desert me, except for one guy. And his name's Dennis Liedstrand, and he's a Christian. I didn't even know what it meant to be a Christian. If you'd have asked me, are you a Christian? I'd have said, well, yeah, I'm an American, sure. I had no idea what it means to be a Christian. And he hung with me and loved me and cared about me. And when I was well enough to run around, he invited me to his church, Fair Oaks Baptist Church, to play basketball. And they had a youth group of about 100 students. And I was just really impressed. And everybody's so friendly. And then he told me about Jesus. And I didn't really get it. I didn't respond. And then his dad told me about Jesus, and I didn't really get it, and I didn't really respond. And then on a Sunday evening, I was sitting all the way in the back of the church, and the pastor talked about a relationship with Christ, and it just clicked. It just clicked. And I remember he invited people to come forward. Two people went forward that evening, a girl all the way in the front and myself all the way in the back. And I'm sure the pastor thought, wow, what a loser evening this was. Only two people going forward. But it was life-changing for me. It was so radical, the change, that 2 days later, my dad knocks on my door. Says, would you come out here? Your mother and I want to talk to you. I go, sure. So I come out, I sit down. My dad looks at me and he goes, what has happened to you? He said, you are so different. I was withdrawn. I had a poor self-image. And when Jesus saved me, I just went from night to day. All of a sudden, I was outgoing. I was funny. I was happy with life. I was saying hi to people. I was doing things. My parents are like, are you on drugs? What is going on? And I told them about the commitment I made to Christ. And a few months later, both my parents became Christians. So my senior year, I'm at Bethel. And Dennis Liedstrand, thank you. You're the only one who cares. Thank you. So it's my senior year. Dennis Liedstrand comes to me and says to me, I want you to come with me to Bethel University. And I said, well, where's Bethel University? And he said, well, it's in beautiful, tropical St. Paul, Minnesota. So I thought, well, tropical sounds good. So I said, well, okay. Well, Bethel is this private Christian college. I am a terrible student. And I'm not exaggerating. Through high school, I got all C's and D's. C's and D's. I'm a bad student. So I said, well, okay. And I take the ACTs, SATs, and God does a miracle. And my counselor calls me in and he goes, what happened to you? And I go, what do you mean? He said, you scored in the top 10% of the nation on the SAT, ACT. I'm like, wow, God blesses guessing. This is awesome. So then I got some really good references sent into Bethel. And I got this little letter from Bethel that said, Greg, Very impressed with the test scores. References are amazing. Let's see how you do your last semester. So I'm working hard, but I'm on the bubble. And we have what's called at our school Senior Cut Day. Now that sounds edgy. It's just really not that edgy because our class president goes in, meets with the principal, they agree on a day, and then the entire senior class cuts. We go to the beach for one last blast, bonfire, being together, all that stuff. So our class president goes in and says, we'd like a Monday or Friday so we can have a long weekend. And the principal goes, man, he goes, I totally get that. And he goes, I'd love to be able to do that, but I can't because we have these things going on, but I can give you a Tuesday or Wednesday. Our president goes, we don't want a Tuesday or Wednesday. We want a Friday or a Monday. He goes, well, I get it, but I can't give it to you, so pick Tuesday or Wednesday. And our president said, we're taking Friday. And the principal said, you don't have permission to take Friday. And our president said, too bad, we're walking. Now, I had to make a decision. Am I going to go to school or am I going to go to the beach? Now, that seems like a no-brainer, doesn't it? Just go to the beach. Go to the beach. All your friends are at the beach. Just go to the beach. So Dennis Liedstrand's dad, Roy Liedstrand, just a godly man. He's discipling me. And I talked to him about that, and he talks to me about being a man of character. And I say to him, whoa. Wait a second, are you telling me that I should go to school? And Roy, in his wisdom, said, I'm not telling you anything. He said, you need to pray, and you just do whatever God tells you to do. Because you know exactly what happened. I prayed, and just clear as a bell, bing, go to school. Go to school. So Friday morning, I show up for school. Three girls, a really smart guy, and me. I walk into my first period class and I sit down. And I'm not real happy because all my friends are at the beach and I'm stuck at school. So the teacher goes, clear your desk. I'm like, yeah, clear my desk. She goes, hey, I got a piece of paper. I'm like, yeah, here's a piece of paper. She goes, put your name in the upper right-hand corner. I go, yeah, there's my name. She goes, we're going to have a test. I'm like, what? Are you kidding me? A test? I didn't know anything about a test. I didn't have time to study. Not that I would have, but I didn't have time. I'm like, oh, thanks a lot, God. She goes, this test will be worth 100 points. I'm like, well, just bury me now. Man, I cannot believe it. She goes, pass your papers in. I'm like, huh? She goes, pass your papers in. I'm like, I hope I spelled my name correctly. She collects the papers. She goes through them slowly. She looks up and she says, you'll all be happy to know you got 100% on this test and there will be no makeup for this test. Every class I went into, clear your desk, take out a piece of paper, put your name in the right-hand corner. We're going to have a test. It's worth 100 points. Pass your papers in. Do you know what this did for my GPA? It made it look like perhaps I had a brain, and Bethel said, come. Now listen, when you act justly and you're a man of character who does what's right in God's sight, does everything always turn out for you? No. Will you ever have problems? Yes. Are you going to suffer? Absolutely. But the pain and the suffering have a different purpose from the world. The suffering and the pain you go through as a Christian shapes you more and more into the image of Christ. So men, I want you to act justly. I just want you to be men of character who do what is right in God's sight. Number two, I want you to love mercy. Honestly, let me ask you, do you love mercy? Do you love mercy? Or do you love revenge? How merciful do you feel behind the wheel of a car when somebody cuts you off? I don't feel merciful. Not at all. Do you know what there's a tendency for us to want? We want mercy for ourselves, and we want justice for others. We want others to deal with the consequences. We don't want to deal with the consequences. What does it mean for you to love mercy? It does not mean you treat somebody the way they deserve. That's not what it means. To love mercy is to treat people the way Jesus Christ treats you. Or let me take it a step further. To love mercy means you treat people the way you want Jesus to treat you. Do you want Jesus to understand you? Then understand them. Do you want Jesus to forgive you? Then forgive them. Do you want Jesus to be patient with you? Then be patient with them. That's what it means to love mercy. Treating people better than what they deserve. And you know where mercy can begin, men? Mercy can begin in your house with your wife. How many of you are married? Put up your hands. How many of you do not have a wife? Put up your hands. Okay? So for you who have your hands up, who do not have a wife, I just want to say this to you. This is applicable to women in general, most of what I'm going to say here. And it's certainly if you're planning on getting married down the road, and I need to know that right now. Okay, I'm just kidding. If you're going to get married down the road, this would be something that would apply when you do get married, okay? So Ephesians chapter 6, just write down the verses and you can look at this later. Verses 28 and 29. It says, in the same way husbands should love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it just as Christ does the church. I want you to nourish and cherish your wife. Yes, it is. Ephesians 5. What did I say? 6? I was just testing you. Thank you. Greg, thank you for pointing that out. Ephesians 5, 28 and 29, yes. So I want you to cherish and nourish your wife. That is you loving mercy. How can you do that? Let me just suggest some ways. One, be trustworthy. Be trustworthy. Never, ever, 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 I don't know if there's enough evers there. Never, ever lie to your wife. Never, ever lie to your wife. Men, never ever lie, period, but especially to your wife. Why? Let me give you four reasons why I don't want you to ever lie. And you might want to jot these down and you can pass these on to others. Number one, because God hates a lying tongue. He hates a lying tongue. How do I know that? Proverbs chapter 6, beginning with verse 16. There are six things the Lord hates, seven that are detestable to him. Haughty eyes, a lying tongue, and on it goes. Could I recommend, men, that you read the rest of that during your free time? Find out what God hates and then avoid those. Number one, do not lie because God hates a lying tongue. Number two, do not lie because if your word doesn't mean anything, you don't mean anything because you are your word. If your word doesn't mean anything, you don't mean anything because you are your word. Turn to the man next to you and tell that man, how did your great-grandfather make a deal with another man? Go. All right, I'm going to illustrate this with Greg. This is what your great-grandfather did. Probably your grandfather did it as well, but certainly your great-grandfather. Here's what they do. We'd look at each other in the eye. We'd make a deal, an understanding, and then we would shake hands. And it was a done deal. Why do you think they have contracts this thick today? Because people are liars. Because people try to rip each other off. Because people try to take advantage of other people. When people call me and say to me, Greg, would you come speak? And I say, man, I'd love to come speak. And they say to us, will you send us a contract? I say to them, I don't have a contract. And the reason why is because my word is my bond. I expect your word to be your bond. However, if you have a contract and you want to send it to me, sure, I have no problem signing that. But people need to know my word means what it says. People need to know your word means what it says. Number three, do not lie because you destroy your trustworthiness. You destroy your trustworthiness. Just remember this. Love is unconditional. Trust is earned. Love is unconditional. Trust is earned. So could somebody look at you and say, I love you, but I don't trust you? Yes. Is that a contradiction? Absolutely not. And how do you earn trust? You earn trust by consistent behavior over a period of time, meaning you have to live it out. If you want to do an illustration with your kids or with your grandkids, go to the dollar store. Everybody has a Dollar General, right? Or a General Dollar. I don't, whatever way that goes. So go in there and buy a vase for $1. $1.25? Oh, man. Just steal it then. Just. All right, put down $1.25. Take the vase out in the driveway. Take your grandchild, your children, give them some work gloves, have them have a box, and say, this represents your trustworthiness. This is what happens when you lie. You break it on the driveway. Then do you say to your grandson, granddaughter, pick up all the pieces, put them in a box. Now go back in the garage. Here's some glue. Now paste this back together again and make it look like new. Now, don't make them do the whole vase. And they'll see how hard it is for them to do that. And then you say to them, that's what happens if you lie. People will find it hard to trust you again. And whose fault is that? It's your fault. It's your fault. And number four, do not lie because you speak Satan's native tongue. John chapter 8 and verse 44. You belong to your father, the devil, and you want to carry out your father's desires. He was a murderer from the beginning, not holding to the truth, for there is no truth in him. When he lies, he speaks his native language, for he is a liar and the father of lies. So when you lie, you speak a language Satan readily understands. It'd be like all of a sudden me being able to speak German. Oh, guten Morgen, wie geht es Ihnen? Geht es dir gut? Oh, das ist wunderbar. It'd be like all of a sudden me being able to speak French. Oh, bonjour. Bonjour de bâton, elle est, je de bâton. Ah, oui? Ah, oui. It'd be like me speaking Italian. Hey, buongiorno, hey, pizza. I don't know. When you lie, you speak a language Satan readily understands. You need to be about the truth. Men, be trustworthy with your wife. Next, make her load lighter, not heavier. One way you can do that is by catching her being good and speaking life into her. What does your wife do that you expect her to do? Because whatever you expect her to do, you stop appreciating her in those areas. When's the last time you thanked her for washing clothes? When's the last time you thanked her for cleaning the house? When's the last time you thanked her for whatever she does on a regular basis? The other day, I took out the garbage and I walked home. I walked back into the house. We take the garbage far away. I walked back in the house and Bonnie says to me, "Thanks for taking out the garbage." I've taken out the garbage once a week for 46 years. And my wife says, "Thanks for taking out the garbage." You keep the romance and the love and the spark alive when you appreciate your wife and you speak life into her. Listen to her. Do you know the three magic words, man? The three magic words. Tell me more. Tell me more. You're going to win huge points on that. I shared that once and the guy in the back was like, "Are you kidding me?" No. Tell me more. So when your wife sits down and shares something with you, instead of you zoning on her, make eye contact with her and at the end, say, "Tell me more about that. I'm interested." That's what you're saying to her. "I'm interested in what you're going through. Listen to her." Pray with her. Every day, pray with her. I read this statistic. It was on the internet, so you know it's true. It said this: 97% of couples who pray regularly together stay together. Every night when you climb into bed, you grab hold of her hand and you pray for her and with her. Some men say to me, "Well, I don't feel comfortable praying out loud." And I say, "Well, you know what? I'm not asking you to come up here and pray. I'm asking you to pray with your covenant partner." And you know what? You didn't feel comfortable when you first started to try to ride a bike. But you didn't give up. You just kept getting on it. Pretty soon, it just was second nature. The same thing is true with prayer. The more you do it, the more comfortable you will be doing it. Pray with her on a regular basis. Be sure you help her fulfill her purpose and dreams. Do not kill your wife's dreams. Sometimes your wife comes to you and says, "I would love to do this." And what's the first thing out of your mouth? "Oh, we can't afford that. Oh, we can't do that. Oh, we can't afford that." What if God's leading her to do that? Your first response needs to be, "Well, let's see how we can make that happen. Let's work together to see how we can make that happen." And men, show her and tell her that you love her. Do that every day. Just say to her, "I love you. I love you. I love you." She needs to hear that all the time. Make romance a priority. Men, I would encourage you, when it comes to your relationship with your wife, stay away from sarcasm. Stay away from sarcasm. At least for me, sarcasm was a wall I hid behind so I didn't have to be vulnerable. And I would zing my wife in fun, and then if it bothered my wife, I'd be like, "Well, what's the matter? Can't you take a joke?" No. Get rid of sarcasm. And love on her. A guy came to his coworker and he said, "Man, my wife and I, we're not getting along at all." Coworker says, "Well, why don't you do what I do?" "Well, what do? "Well, as soon as work's done, I go in the back room and I walk over and I open my locker and I got a clean shirt in there and I got some deodorant. And I take off my old shirt and I take the deodorant and I put on a clean shirt. Then I walk out and I open the glove box And I got cologne in the glove box, and I just spray that cologne on. And then on the way home, I stop and I buy some flowers. And then I walk in the house, and I grab my wife, and I bend her over, and I give her a passionate kiss, and I say, I love you. And then I stand her up, and I hand her the flowers, and I say to her, these flowers pale in comparison to your beauty. The guy's like, wow. All right, I'll try it. So next day, he goes to the back room. He opens the locker, and there's a clean shirt, and puts on the deodorant, puts on the clean shirt, goes out to the car, opens a glove box, sprays on some cologne, and then he drives home, and on the way home, he stops. He gets some flowers. He walks in the house. His wife's in the kitchen preparing dinner. He walks in. He grabs her. He spins her around. He bends her over, kisses her, stands her up, says, I love you, hands her the flowers, and says, these flowers pale in comparison to your beauty. And she just drops her head, and she just starts to sob. And the guy goes, what is wrong? And she goes, this has been the worst day. The kids have been terrible. I couldn't get the car started. The washing machine broke, and now you come home drunk. So I know it may be a shock to her, but do it anyway. Okay, he has shown you, O mortal, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you? To act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. Can I remind you that this needs to be your God? This cannot be your wife's God, your children's God, your pastor's God, your friend's God. It's got to be your God. And you walk humbly with him because you realize all the gifts, abilities, and talents you have come from him. You have nothing to have a big head over. I learned early on as a communicator, if God can speak to a donkey, he can speak to anybody. He doesn't need me. I'm just honored and privileged and humbled that he chooses to use me. Men, we exist to glorify God. We exist to glorify God. We do that as we walk humbly with him. And what does it mean for you to glorify God? It means you make God look good. Because by our lives, we can choose to make God look good in the eyes of the world, or we can choose to make him look bad, look good. By what comes out of your mouth. And by the way, man, I understand you have people around you all the time dropping the F-bomb. I know that. That doesn't mean you should drop the F-bomb. By the way you talk and by the way you act and your attitude, you need to make Jesus look good. You need to make him a reality so people around you can see that. Men, God continues to have awesome plans for your life. I want you to follow him, act justly, love mercy, and make sure he's your God. Thank you, Jim.
That verse,
thank you, brother. Thank you.